stonily. "Let us assume that there may be those here who choose, for one reason or another, to refuse to worship Carpathia. Perhaps they are independent spirits. Perhaps they are rebellious Jews. Perhaps they are secret Judahites who still believe their man is the only way to God. Regardless of their justification, they shall surely die." The crowd recoiled, and many gasped. "Marvel not that I say unto you that some shall surely die. If Carpathia is not God, and I am not his chosen one, then I shall be proved wrong. If Carpathia is not the only way and the only life, then what I say is not the only truth, and none should fear. It is only fair that I offer proof of my role, in addition to what you have already seen and heard from Nikolai Carpathia's own image. I call on the power of my Most High God to prove that he rules from heaven by burning to death with his pure extinguishing fire those who would oppose me, those who would deny his deity, those who would subvert and plot and scheme to take my rightful place as his spokesman. He paused dramatically. Then, I pray he does this even as I speak. Leon turned to face the 10 potentates and pointed at the 3 who opposed him. Great beams of fire burst from the cloudless skies and incinerated the 3 where they sat. The other 7 leaped from their seats to avoid the heat and flames, and even the guards backpedaled. The crowd shrieked and wailed, but no one moved. No one ran. Every soul seemed paralyzed with fear, and the fire that left the 3 smoldering in tiny piles of ash disappeared as quickly as it had come. Fortunato spoke again. Faithful patriots of the global community from the 3 regions formerly led by men of lying tongues, take heart. Their replacements have already been selected in meetings I have enjoyed with the spirit of Nikolai Carpathia himself. The global community shall prevail. We shall reach our goal of utopian living, harmony, love, and tolerance. Tolerance of all but those who refuse to worship the image of the man we esteem and glorify today. It was clear Fortunato expected applause, but the gathered were so stunned, so filled with terror, that they merely stared. You may express yourselves, Leon said with a smile. Still no one moved, his eyes narrowed. You may express your agreement, he said, and tentative clapping began. You need not fear your Lord God, he said as the applause continued. What you have witnessed here shall never befall you if you love Nikolai with the love that brought you here to honor his memory. Now before the interment, once everyone has had a chance to pay last respects, I invite you to come and worship. Come and worship. Worship your God, your dead yet living King. Rayford followed Albie's signal and fanned left while Chloe was sent right. The 3, about 30 paces apart, advanced upon the safe house from 200 yards away. They watched for signs of GC. Had they been there? Were they yet there? Were they coming? Suddenly, Albie dropped into the grass and signaled Rayford and Chloe to do the same. He had taken a call. Then he signaled them to join him. Zion hears the engine noises again, he whispered. Coming from the north, only steady this time, as if advancing. He spoke as he dialed Leah. We're going to beat them to the safe house on foot, so be ready to run, and if we encounter GC, stay a step or two behind me. Leah? Give us about 90 seconds, then come fast with lights on. Just be careful not to overtake us. When we stop, you stop as close to the garage as you can. Stay in the vehicle with the lights on, and don't worry if you see GC Jeeps coming the other way. Albie slapped the phone shut, unholstered his sidearm, bounced to his feet, and said, "Let's go." As Rayford loped along in the darkness, wondering how many minutes he might have left on Earth, he was impressed that Chloe had no trouble keeping pace. He also wondered at the strange difference in Albie. He had always been resourceful, but was there something else about him now, besides his new profession of faith? Rayford wondered why he had not assured himself of the integrity of Albie's mark. Could he be sure of anything he saw under the dim interior light of the rover, a wounded old man between him and Albie? Chapter 19. Mr. Wong dropped to his knees next to David, weeping and crying out in his native tongue. His wife sat rocking, fists clenched, eyes closed, appearing more stunned than convinced. Ming and Chang sat with hands covering their eyes, appearing to pray. To anyone else, it might appear they were praying to the new god of the world. But David knew. He found it surreal that as Fortunato backed away from the lectern and joined the seven remaining potentates, they seemed to ignore the piles of ashes. They solemnly shook hands with their new leader, appearing to congratulate him on his speech and his display of power. The security chief instructed his people to remove the barricade from in front of the single-file line. The couple in Dutch garb first refused to move toward the bier, but those behind them began to jostle and push, urging them on. The couple smiled with embarrassment, each clearly wanting the other to go first. They finally locked arms and shuffled along with mincing steps, seeming to want to see Carpathia's body, but afraid of not only the gigantic speaking and smoke-belching statue, but also the seats behind the bier, three of which contained only ashes. Fortunato and the remaining seven stood in front of the row of seats just far enough behind the coffin to stay out of the guard's way, and so that mourners wouldn't be tempted to shake their hands or speak with them. It appeared to David that it suddenly came to Leon why people were shy about approaching. He turned first to one side and then the other and asked the potentates to move away from him. Then he stepped back and, with a flourish, swept the ashes from each of the three seats, brushing and tidying them with his big hands. This stopped the processional and made anyone close by stare in amazement. With a satisfied look, Leon turned back to face the bier and motioned that the seven should rejoin him. As they did, he clapped and rubbed his hands together, and the residue fell away. He and the potentates enjoyed a chuckle. Three sets of headlights appeared on the horizon, maybe a half mile beyond the safe house. Rayford had feared this day when the GC would swoop down upon them. He worried he would be gone or sleeping or unaware. How bizarre to be here and see it happening. Albie and Chloe had picked up the pace and sprinted now. Rayford tried, but found himself suddenly awkward and feeling his age again. "Closer to me now, Captain Steele," Albie called out, then hollered the same to Chloe. Rayford and Chloe closed ranks, now 10 or 12 feet on either side of Albie and about 4 feet back. Behind them, the roaring Land Rover came bouncing over the terrain, projecting eerie shadows on the safe house. It seemed to Rayford that the three vehicles advancing from the other way had slowed and separated. He and Albie and Chloe stopped between the old garage and the house, and Leah skidded the Land Rover to Chloe's right next to the garage. "Hold," Albie said quietly. "Hold and maintain positions." "We're vulnerable, Albie," Rayford said. "Deputy Commander Elbaz, Mr. Berry," Albie said. "And you have ceded command to me, have you not?" "Temporarily," Rayford said ruefully. If Albie was legit, he could take it as a joke. If Rayford had stupidly fallen for something and had sacrificed the Tribulation Force to a lapse in judgment, he was saying he would wrest back command and not go down without a fight. The headlights before them now spread out, the vehicle to Rayford's left heading farther that way, angling toward them and stopping about 75 yards away. The one in the middle advanced closer, maybe 50 yards away, and the one to the right mirrored the one on the left. "Hold," Albie said again. "Hold!" "We're targets here," Rayford said. "Hold!" "I don't feel good about this," Chloe said. "Hold! Trust me!" Rayford held his breath. "I wish I could. Lord, tell me I did the right thing." Rayford started when he heard someone jump out of the center vehicle, equipment jangling as he hit the ground and moved toward the house. While he could still see all three sets of headlights, Rayford lost behind the house the silhouette of the soldier hurrying their way. "Hold!" "I'm holding, Al, Deputy Commander, while they have an armed man on the other side of the house. What if he torches the place? What if the others join him? They have clear shots at us while they're protected by trees in the house." "Silence, Mr. Berry," Albie said. "We are outmanned 12-3. Rayford felt a deep foreboding. How would he know that? "And unless one of you is packing," Albie added, "we are out-armed 12-1. "So what?" Chloe said. "We're surrendering? I'll die first." "You might if you don't let me handle this." Rayford had gone from suspicion to fear and now to full-blown dread. He had walked his charges into the biggest trap imaginable. Wasn't it Albie himself who had once counseled to never trust anyone? They could be dead or in prison within half an hour. "Global Community Squadron Leader," Albie shouted, his voice deep and clear and louder than Rayford had ever heard it. "Show and identify yourself. I am GC Deputy Commander Marcus Elbaz, and that is an order." David guessed the temperature at 110 degrees. He couldn't remember being out at midday in New Babylon when it was this hot. He removed his uniform cap and wiped a sleeve across his brow. He was dripping. There was no wind. Just the relentless sun, the body heat of 4 million people, and the acrid smoke from the imposing statue. The image began to move as if an earth tremor made it sway and bounce, but nothing else was affected. All eyes turned toward it in terror, and word spread quickly throughout the courtyard that something was happening. For a long minute, the thing seemed to vibrate in place. Then it rocked, and the smoke began to billow once more. The image soon glowed red-hot, and the smoke poured out so fast that it again formed clouds that darkened the sky. The temperature dropped immediately, but going from daylight to dusk so quickly made many fall to their faces. The image roared, "Fear not and flee not! Flee not, or you shall surely die!" The blackness covered the sky in the immediate area, but when David sneaked a glance at the horizon, it remained light. At the edges, all the way around as he turned, lightning burst from the low-riding smoke and struck the ground. Seconds later, the thunderclaps rolled in, shaking the area. "Flee not," the image shouted again. "Defy me at your peril." Leon stood with his arms folded, gazing at the statue as the seven potentates dropped to all fours, wide-eyed. The armed guards fell to their knees. People at the far edges of the crowd turned and ran, only to be struck by lightning as the rest of the throng watched in horror. "You would defy me," the statue roared. "Be silent, be still, fear not, flee not. And behold!" People froze in place, staring. The smoke stopped rising, yet the sky remained dark. It formed itself into roiling, growing black clouds mixed with deep reds and purples. David, secure in his faith and believing he knew what was going on, still found himself shaking, shuddering, heart ablaze. "Gaze not upon me," the statue said, now with no smoke coming from its face. As it cooled, it faded from orange to red and back to black. It no longer moved. "Gaze upon your Lord God." It was as if the statue had shrunk, David thought, but it had merely become still, silent, and cold. People slowly rose, and all eyes turned upon the glass coffin where Carpathia, unmolested, remained reposed. Millions stood in the quickly cool desert, the sky pitch, horrifying clouds churning. The people folded their arms against the sudden chill. Shoulders hunched, they stared at Carpathia's lifeless body. "I have 11 peacekeepers with weapons trained on you, sir," came the reply from the far corner of the safe house. "I'll need to see some identification." "Fair enough," Albi called back, "but be prepared with your own, as I am your superior officer. I suggest we meet on your side of the house with weapons holstered." "Agreed," Albi said, making a show of returning his sidearm to its strapped sheath on his belt. "And your aides?" "Same as yours, sir," Albi said. "Weapons trained on you." The squadron leader stepped out from behind the house with his weapons secured, arms away from his body, hands empty. Albi stepped toward him with purpose. "Excellent approach, sir. I'm reaching for my papers now." "As am I." The squadron leader pulled the flashlight from behind his belt, and they compared documents. "Sorry for the confusion, Deputy Commander," the young man said. "Do I know you?"
"You should, Datilo. I likely taught you. Where did you train?"
"Basalt, sir. Baltimore Area Squadron Leadership Training."
"I only guest lectured there. I was at Chesapeake."
"Yes, sir."
"Squadron Leader Datilo, may I ask what you're doing here?"
Datilo pulled order papers from his pocket. "We were led to believe this was headquarters of a Judahite faction, maybe even the Central Safe House. Our orders were to lay siege to it, apprehend any occupants, determine the whereabouts and identities of any others, and destroy the facility."
"Torch it?"
"Affirmative, sir."
Suddenly, Albi moved closer to the young squadron leader. "Datilo, where did these orders come from?"
"I assumed New Babylon, sir."
"You assumed? Did you check them with the regional director?"
"No, sir, I..."
"Datilo, do you know what time it is?"
"Sir?"
"Do we not both speak English, Datilo?" "It's not my mother tongue, but it's yours. Is my accent too thick for you, son?"
"No, sir."
"Do you know what time it is?"
"After 0400 hours, sir. Requesting permission to check my watch."
"Granted."
"It's 0430, sir."
"It's 0430, Datilo. Does that mean anything to you?"
"Mean anything, sir?"
"Listen to me, squadron leader. I'm going to tell you this outside the listening range of your subordinates, though you don't deserve it. I'm going to resist the temptation to inform North American States Midwest Regional Director Crawford that you did not check orders through him before proceeding. And I'm even going to give you a pass on your unbelievable lack of awareness of the time zone differences between North America and the Carpathian states. I ask you again, Squadron Leader Datilo, what is the significance of 0430 hours?
"I beg your pardon, Deputy Commander, and I appreciate your lenience on the other matters, particularly not embarrassing me in the presence of my subordinates. But, sir, I am drawing a complete blank on the time issue."
"Honestly," Albi said, "I don't know where they get you kids or what you're doing during basic training. Did you or did you not sit in any of my guest lectures at Basalt?"
"I honestly don't recall, sir."
"Then you didn't, because you wouldn't have forgotten, and you would know what time it is in New Babylon when it's 0430 in your part of the world."
"Well, if you mean do I know the time difference, yes, sir, I do."
You do? Yes, sir. I'm listening. At this time of the year, there's a 9-hour time difference. Very good, Datilo. What time does that make it in New Babylon right now?
Let's see, they're later than we are, so it's 1330 hours.
Do I have to walk you through this, son?
I'm sorry, sir, I'm afraid so.
What is today, Squadron Leader?
Saturday, sir.
You lose. Try again. It's after midnight, officer.
Oh, yeah, it's Sunday morning already.
Which makes it what in New Babylon?
Sunday afternoon.
It's Sunday afternoon in New Babylon, Datilo. Ring any bells?
Datilo's shoulders slumped.
It's the funeral, isn't it, sir?
Ding, 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 ding. Datilo hits the jackpot.
You're aware of the moratorium on combat-related activity anywhere in the world during the funeral, are you not?
Yes, sir.
And every GC directive requires CPR, correct?
Concrete peacekeeping reasoning, yes, sir.
And the CPR behind this directive?
That no untoward publicity crowd out the funeral as the top news story.
There you go. Now, Datilo, I can tell you're an earnest young man. You and your people are going to evacuate this area. You may return at 1000 hours and torch this place if I leave it standing. My people and I were onto this location long before you were, and we have already apprehended the occupants and evacuated the building. I have a crew here to comb the residence for evidence, and we should be finished by dawn. Do not return until 1000, and if you see smoke on the horizon before that, you'll have no need to come then either. Have I made myself clear?
Yes, sir.
Any way my people and I can assist, sir? Only by following orders and leaving now. And I'll make a deal with you, son. You don't tell your superiors of the serious mistakes you made this morning, and I won't either.
I appreciate that, sir.
I know you do. Now move out.
Datilo saluted and trotted back to the middle jeep. It popped a U-turn, as did the other two before falling in line behind it. And they raced off in the darkness. The sky was so black that the lights of the palace courtyard came on automatically. The TV lights were trained on the coffin, and David was sure every eye but his was, too. He searched and searched Sector 53 for Annie, praying she would stand strong. He couldn't locate her. David turned back. Heat waves shimmered off the statue in the comparatively chilly air. The potentates appeared paralyzed. Even Fortunato had paled and wasn't moving, his gaze on the casket. A rim of light along the horizon looked like the rim of hair on a bald man. Clouds of ebony and other deep shades, produced by smoke from the statue, hung ominously over the immense gathering. People stood stock still, riveted. Brilliant lights bathed the platform. David's eyes were drawn to the body.
What was that? Almost imperceptible movement? Or had it been his imagination? He had imagined a corpse's chest rising and falling at a funeral before, but until now, Carpathia's body hadn't given even the illusion of life. Carpathia's left index finger lifted an inch off his wrist for an instant, then fell again. A few people gasped, but David assumed most hadn't seen it. Then it rose and fell twice. Next, it lifted half an inch, uncurling as if pointing. One of the potentates apparently saw that and recoiled, trying to back away, but falling over a chair. As he scrambled to his feet and tried to exit, lightning struck 10 feet from him and knocked him back to where he had been. He stood shakily and brushed himself off, reluctantly looking at Carpathia again. Now the index finger twitched, and all the potentates stiffened. The guards went into assault position as if prepared to shoot a dead body. Carpathia's hands separated and rested at his sides. Those close enough began to weep, their faces contorted in terror. It seemed they wanted to escape but couldn't move.
Those ahead of David edged closer, careful to keep someone between them and the beer. Those in front held their ground or tried to step back, but no one behind them would have that. Now it was clear that Carpathia's chest did rise and fall. Many fell to their knees, hiding their eyes, crying out. Nikolai's eyes popped open. David stared, then tore his gaze away to see even Leon and the kings trembling. The corpse's lips separated, and Nikolai lifted his head until it pressed against the plexiglass lid. Everyone within 100 yards of the coffin, including Fortunato, collapsed, covering their faces, but David noticed most peeking through intertwined fingers. As if stretching, Carpathia tilted his head back, grimaced, and lifted his knees until they, too, met the lid of the casket. He straightened his left leg until his heel met the large rubber stopper and forced it free with a loud thwack. The plug flew out and knocked the cap off one of the prostrate guards. He dropped his weapon and rubbed his head as the projectile bounced and rolled and finally stopped under a chair. With the vacuum seal broken, Carpathia slowly brought his hands to his chest, palms up, heels of his hands resting on the underside of the lid. Moans and gasps and shrieks came from the crowd for as far as David could see and hear. Everyone was on the ground now, either peering at the screens or trying to see the platform. Carpathia lifted his knees again, ripping the massive stainless steel bolts free of the glass. Then he pushed mightily until the top end shattered loose. The lid, more than 80 pounds of plexiglass, flew away from the coffin, bolts flying, and smashed into the lectern, knocking it over and taking the microphone with it. Carpathia catapulted himself to a standing position in the narrow end of his coffin. He turned triumphantly to face the crowd, and David noticed makeup, putty, surgical staples, and stitches in the box where Nikolai's head had lain. Standing there before now deathly silence, Nikolai looked as if he had just stepped out of his closet where a valet had helped him into a crisp suit. Shoes gleaming, laces taut, socks smooth, suit unwrinkled, tie hanging just so, he stood broad-shouldered, fresh-faced, shaven, hair in place, no pallor. Fortunato and the seven were on their knees, hiding their faces, sobbing aloud. Nikolai raised his hands to shoulder height and said loudly enough for everyone to hear, without aid of a microphone, "Peace! Be still!" With that, the clouds ascended and vanished, and the sun reappeared in all its brilliance and heat. People squinted and covered their eyes. "Peace be unto you," he said. "My peace I give to you. Please stand." He paused while everyone rose, eyes still locked on him, bodies rigid with fear. "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in me." Murmuring began. David heard people marveling that he wasn't using a microphone, but neither was he raising his voice, and yet everyone could hear. It was as if Carpathia read their minds. "You marvel that I speak directly to your hearts without amplification, yet you saw me raise myself from the dead. Who but the Most High God has power over death? Who but God controls the earth and sky?" Hands still raised, he spoke gently. "Do you still tremble? Are you still sore afraid? Fear not, for I bring you good tidings of great joy. It is I who loves you who stands before you today, wounded unto death, but now living for you. For you. You need never fear me, for you are my friends. Only my enemies need fear. Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Come to me, and you will find rest for your souls." David nearly fainted from nausea.
to hear the words of Jesus from this evil man, whom Dr. Ben-Judah taught was now indwelt, Satan incarnate, was almost more than he could take. "Only he who is not with me is against me," Carpathia continued. "Anyone who speaks a word against me, it will not be forgiven him. But as for you, the faithful, be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid."
David searched for Annie again, knowing that no one around him was even aware he wasn't paying attention to Carpathia. How he wished he could see her, know she was all right, communicate to her that she was not alone, that other believers were here.
"I want to greet you," Carpathia said. "Come to me, touch me, talk to me, worship me. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. I will be with you always, even to the end."
The line that had frozen in place still didn't move. Carpathia turned to Fortunato and nodded, gesturing to the guards.
"Urge my own to come to me."
Slowly the guards rose and began to nudge the people toward the stairs again.
"And as you come," Carpathia continued, "let me speak to you about my enemies."
Zion had sat praying as vehicles approached the safe house from two directions.
"Is this the end, Lord?" he said.
"I so long to come to you. But if it is not the due time for my beloved brothers and sisters and me to give our lives for you, give us all strength and wisdom."
The vehicle stopped, and he heard shouting. Zion moved to the corner of the cellar where he could hear. A Middle Eastern GC commander was calling out a squadron commander. Zion tried to slow and regulate his breathing so he could hear every word. Was that Albi, the one he had just spoken to, pretending to be GC? Or was he GC? He was so convincing, so knowledgeable. How could a man know so much about systems and procedures without being on the inside? Or perhaps he once was and had turned. Zion could only hope. Whatever he was, Albi had driven off the squadron commander and his men, and Zion knew his friends would now come for him. His first order of business? He turned the power back on and fired up the TV. His phone rang.
"Dr. Ben-Judah," Albi said, "are you down there and all right?"
"I am fine and watching the funeral on TV. Come down and see."
"Do you want to come and let us in?"
"Break in. I don't want to miss this, and we're not staying anyway, are we?"
Albi chuckled and the back door was kicked in. Footsteps. The freezer door opened, the rack pulled aside, footsteps on the stairs. Albi entered, followed by Chloe, who raced to pull Kenny from his crib and smother him with kisses, then Rayford, looking grave even as he embraced Zion.
"The others are coming," Rayford said.
"Yes, yes, and praise God," Zion said. "But watch this. A great storm has invaded the palace courtyard, and I'm convinced the hour is near."
Buck limped gingerly down the stairs and found Chloe and Kenny. Leah followed, carefully aiding Chaim. Bandaged, mute, and fragile, still he forced a grin when he saw Zion and the countrymen embraced.
"I praise the Lord for you, my brother," Zion said. "Now sit and watch."
"We want to get this done before dawn, people," Albi said. "I don't think our young friend will return until 10, but we'd better not test him."
"Are we really going to torch this place once we've got what we want?" Rayford said. Zion tried to shush them, but both ignored him. He turned up the TV.
"This seems pretty risky," Buck said, emerging from the bedroom with Chloe and Kenny, "partying down here with GC in the area."
"I believe the indwelling is about to occur," Zion announced.
"Put a video disc in, Zion," Rayford said. "We've got work to do, and fast."
"I am confident Albi's ruse was successful," Zion said. "At least I hope so."
Rayford approached him. "Doctor," he said, "I'm back and I'm in charge, and I need to pull rank despite my respect for you. Record that, and let's get packing."
Zion read such confidence and also concern in Rayford that he immediately popped in a disc.
"Chaim, you can't work in your condition. Monitor this for me until we have to go."
He hurried upstairs.
"Bring only what you can carry on your lap," Rayford announced. "Tying stuff atop the car would attract too much attention."
As Zion busied himself, he worried about Rayford. It was natural for them all to be relieved and yet worried they weren't out of the woods yet. Rayford was plainly agitated about something. After Zion gave his room one last cursory glance for any indispensables, he saw Rayford pull Albie into Buck and Chloe's empty first-floor bedroom.
"You all know me as a forgiving potentate," Carpathia said as the masses began to queue up once more to file past him. This time they would have the weird experience of touching and chatting with a man who had been dead nearly 3 days and who still stood in the remains of his own coffin. "Ironically," he continued, "the person or persons responsible for my demise may no longer be pursued for murder. Attempted murder of a government official is still an international felony, of course. The guilty know who they are. But as for me, I hereby pardon any and all. No official action is to be taken by the government of the global community. What steps fellow citizens may take to ensure that such an act never takes place again, I do not know and will not interfere with. However, individual would-be assassins aside, there are opponents to the global community and to my leadership. Hear me, my people. I need not and will not tolerate opposition. You need not fear because you came here to commemorate my life on the occasion of my death, and you remain to worship me as your divine leader. But to those who believe it is possible to rebel against my authority and survive, beware. I shall soon institute a program of loyalty confirmation that will prove once and for all who is with us and who is against us. And woe to the haughty insurrectionist. He will find no place to hide. Now, loyal subjects, come and worship."
Chapter 20. Rayford pulled Albie into Buck and Chloe's bedroom by his elbow. As he was shutting the door, he saw Chaim staggering toward Zion, gesturing, grunting through his bandages and wired jaw, trying to get Zion to follow. Rayford's phone rang. "Stay put," Rayford told Albie. Then into the phone. "Steele here."
"Rayford, it's Hattie."
She was near hysterics. "Where are you?" he said.
"The less you know, the better, but get your people out of the safe house."
"Why?"
"They're on to you. Don't ask me how I know. And Carpathia has come back from the dead, did you see?"
"No."
"It's all true, isn't it, Rayford?"
"Of course it is, and you knew that almost as soon as most of us did. I didn't think doubt was why you were holding out."
"It wasn't, totally, but I was still holding out hope that it couldn't all be just the way Dr. Ben-Judah said."
"What are you going to do about it, Hattie? You know how we all feel about it, and about you."
"Nothing right now, Rayford. I just wanted to warn you."
"Thanks, but now I'm warning you. Don't wait any longer."
"I have to go, Rayford."
"Dr. Rosenzweig has made his decision."
"I've really got to..."
"What?
He has? He was supposed to be dead. Is he there? May I talk with him?"
"I'll have him call you when he's able."
"I don't want my phone ringing at the wrong time."
"Then call us back tomorrow, Hattie. Hear? We'll all be praying you do the right thing."
David didn't know where Viv Ivins had been sitting. Surely she had been in the VIP section, but he didn't notice her until she appeared at Carpathia's side. Fortunato was to her right, so as people swept past, they encountered first Leon, then Viv, and finally Carpathia. It was as if this setup was designed to put people at ease. They need not fear a recently dead man who wanted to touch and be touched. Leon gently pushed them to Viv, who said something soothing and guided them quickly past Carpathia. He seemed to be looking each one in the eye and cooing something as he grasped his or her hand with both of his. No one was allowed to pause, and all seemed overcome as they floated away. Many swooned, and some passed out. David did some quick figuring. If Nikolai gave, say, 3 million people 5 or 6 seconds apiece, it would take more than 224-hour days. Surely those who waited more than a few hours would give up. "Can this wait, Captain Steele?" Albie said. Rayford blocked his path. "Why, Albie? Don't you want to see what's happening on the news? I'll watch the replay." "So you want to see it, too?" "Of course," Rayford said. "But I'm starting to wonder if we want to see it for the same reason." "What are you saying?" "What is your real name?" "You know my name, Rayford. May I check your mark?" Albie squinted at him. "In my culture, that is a terrible insult, especially after everything we've been through." "Your culture never had the mark before. What's the insult?" "To not be personally trusted." "You yourself advised me to trust no one." "That's a principle, my friend. You think I would fake and lie to you about something I know to be so real to you?" "I don't know." "Then you had better check my mark. You couldn't insult me further." "Take it as a compliment, Albie. If you're for real, you were so convincing as a GC commander that you made me wonder."
"I must have."
"You did. How did you know we were outmanned 12-3? "I do my homework. It's part of the job. How do you think I outlived the average black marketer by 2 times? I'm careful. I don't just find a uniform and affect an identity without learning the nuances." "How did you know 3 jeeps carried 4 peacekeepers each?"
"That is GC protocol. Night patrols are called squadrons and have a leader, 3 vehicles, and 11 subordinates. By day, they travel in pairs."
"Uh-huh. And basalt?"
"Never heard of it. I was glad he explained."
"Guest lecturing?"
"Made it up."
"Chesapeake?"
"Guessing, hoping. I had read something about a GC training facility there. I'm glad I was so convincing, Rayford, because our lives depended on it. It's what I do."
"Midwest Regional, what did you call him, director?"
"Director Crawford, right."
"And you know him from?"
"A directory I thought it would behoove me to familiarize myself with."
"You've never met him?"
"How would I?"
"You're still a closet hater of Carpathia?"
"Out of the closet soon, I hope. I don't enjoy long-term play acting."
"Satisfied?" "How do you know about the funeral moratorium and, what did you call it, CPR?
"I read."
"You read?"
"You should know that about me. I think I need to know a lot more about you."
Now Albie was mad.
"I won't pretend not to be deeply offended," he said, ripping off his uniform cap and slamming it to the floor.
Rayford was suddenly aware that they alone remained on the main floor, and he heard no footsteps above. Everyone must have been huddled around the television in the underground shelter. Albie unstrapped his gun and drew it, Rayford retreating until the back of his head hit the bedroom door. Albie turned the weapon around so he was holding the barrel. He thrust it at Rayford.
"Here," he said. "Shoot me if I'm a liar."
Rayford hesitated.
"Go on, take it."
"I'm not going to shoot you, Albie."
"Even if I'm a phony? Even if I turned on you, lied to you, compromised you? Even if I was GC after all?"
"Let me tell you, Captain Steele, if that were true about me and I were you, I would shoot me without remorse. He stood offering the weapon. But I will say this. If I were GC, this is where and when I would shoot you too. And I would kill every one of your comrades as they rushed from the underground. Then I would secure the place and let Squadron Commander Datillo burn the evidence to the ground. What will it be, Captain Steele? This is a limited offer. Hadn't you better check me to see if you signed the death warrants of all your friends? Or will you risk their lives to keep from insulting me further? Rayford would not reach for the gun, so Albie tossed it on the bed. Rayford wished he had taken it, not sure whether he could beat Albie to it now if he had to. Albie took a step closer, making Rayford flinch, but Albie merely stuck his forehead in Rayford's face. Touch it! Rub it! Wash it! Put petrol on it! Do whatever you have to do to convince yourself. I already know who I am. If I'm phony, shoot me. If I'm real, assume I have turned command back over to you. Either way, you could not have offended me more. I don't mean to offend you, Albie, but I must just get on with it. If you are to be the leader, take command. David scanned the far reaches of the crowd where carts zigzagged with bullhorns, advising the people that the GC regretted to inform them that only those already inside the courtyard will be able to greet His Excellency personally. Thanks for your understanding, and do feel free to remain for final remarks in an hour or so. David searched and searched for Annie, finally telling the Wong family he had to go. Mr. Wong, his face ravaged by tears and exhaustion, said, "No! You get us into receiving line." "I'm sorry," David said. "They've closed the line."
"But we in courtyard. VIP seat. You make happen."
"No," David said, leaning close. "You're the VIP. You make it happen." As the older man sputtered, David squeezed Mom's shoulder and embraced both Ming and Chang, whispering in their ears, "Jesus is risen." Both responded under their breath, "He is risen indeed." "Forgive me, Albie," Rayford said. "Please don't be insulted." "You have already insulted me, my friend, so you might as well put your mind at ease." "I'm trying to put your mind at ease, Albie." "That will require more of an apology than you have the time or energy, or, I may say, insight to give. Now check the mark, and let's get out of here." Rayford reached for Albie, who seemed to stiffen. A loud rap on the door made them both jump. Zion poked his head in. "My apologies, gentlemen, but Carpathia has resurrected. You must come see." Rayford retrieved the gun. "Keep it," Albie said as they headed downstairs. "But that would insult you even more." "I told you I cannot be more deeply insulted." Rayford reached back awkwardly, holding the gun out to Albie. Albie shook his head, grabbed the gun, and slammed it into his holster. As he snapped the strap, he said, "The only thing more offensive than not being trusted by an old friend is your simpering style of leadership. Rayford, you and those you are responsible for are entering the most dangerous phase of your existence. Don't blow it with indecision and poor judgment." Buck held the sleeping baby while Chloe finished packing. He heard Rayford and Albie descending and wondered why they were empty-handed after having been upstairs for so long. Maybe they had already carried stuff to the car. "Did you see this, Dad?" he said, nodding toward the TV, where GCCNN played and replayed the most dramatic moments from New Babylon. "Better not refer to me informally in front of the rest of the force," Rayford whispered as he stared at the TV. Buck cocked his head. "Whatever you say, Captain Steele." He limped to where Chloe had gathered their essentials, traded the baby for a bundle, and slowly made his way out to the Land Rover. The coolness of the pre-dawn refreshed him, though he caught himself sniffing the air and listening. The last thing he wanted after the bizarre story of Albie's ruse was to hear those GC jeeps returning. What if the squadron leader was braver than Albie gave him credit for, and he risked embarrassment and even reprimand to check out the story? He'd be back with more help, and they could all be imprisoned or killed, and the place destroyed. Buck worried about some of his injuries. He had pain in both legs that felt sharper than soft tissue damage, so he worried about broken bones. He was certain he'd also cracked a rib or two and couldn't imagine that Chaim hadn't as well. They shared whiplash trauma, even though their heads had first been driven forward. Buck caught a glimpse of himself in the cracked outside rearview mirror of the Rover as he stepped away from the vehicle. Was it possible he was only 33? He felt even worse than he looked, and he looked 50. A fabric burn on his forehead he hadn't even noticed in the hospital had formed a large, ugly scab that was tender to the touch. That had to have come from the first impact and the forcing of his head into the back of the seat in front of him. Deep lacerations from dropping into a woody bush at the Jerusalem airport what seemed eons ago had healed as high-ridged scars with crimson centers that covered his chin, cheeks, and forehead. Worse, his eyes had that world-weary look, a deep fatigue that combined survival desperation, love and concern for his wife and child, and the sheer exhaustion of living as a fugitive and enduring searing personal losses. He took a deep breath that brought stinging pain to his ribs. He wondered where he might next sleep, but he didn't wonder if he would sleep well. Buck would have returned inside to help, but in his condition he was more help staying put. The others began to straggle out under heavy bundles, except for Zion, who had just two full pillowcases tied together over one shoulder and was supporting Chaim on his other arm. Albie, the last out, was on the phone. Rayford arranged the seating. He put Chloe, Kenny, Leah, Zion, and Chaim in the back seat, where they were barely able to close the doors. Buck would ride shotgun in the front with Albie in the middle and Rayford driving. First, however, Rayford and Albie stood between the garage and the house, Albie still on the phone, and Rayford beckoned Buck with a nod. "The chopper is at Pulwalkie," Albie reported. "And the shuttle pilots are on their way back to Rantoul in the trail plane. You want my advice, Captain?" "You bet." "I say we go directly to the airstrip and put the wounded and as much of the luggage in the chopper as we can. Then you can fly the chopper to the new safe house and someone else can drive." "And you?" "I should take the fighter to Kankakee. You can pick me up there later in the chopper and I can fly the Gulfstream into Kankakee." "How about torching this place?" Rayford said. "You have materials? Kerosene and gasoline in the garage, some flares." "That would do it. Have you left anything incriminating inside?" "Not that I can think of. You, Buck?" Buck shook his head. "I'd light her up." "That's me, too," Rayford said. "Just in case, leave 'em nothing to find." Albie looked at his watch. "I think we're pressing our luck. Let the GC waste time digging through it, and then they can cook it. We need to be gone from here as soon as we can." "You're the expert," Rayford said. "You want to vote, Buck?" "I'm with you, Captain." At Pulwalkie, Albie stayed in character and informed the in-residence tower man that the procurement of the chopper and the fuel for the fighter and Gulfstream should all be kept under the same GC order number. Greasy-haired and short on sleep, the big man seemed as thrilled as he had been hours before to be doing his duty to the GC and particularly to the deputy commander.
"Did you see the news, sir?" the man said. "The wonderful, wonderful news?"
"Did I ever," Albie said. "Thanks for your kindness. Now we must be off."
"My pleasure, Deputy Commander, sir." "A pleasure indeed. If you ever need anything else, don't hes—"
Buck was left to nod to the man. Albie was off to the freshly refueled jet and Rayford to the chopper.
David searched and searched for Annie, unable to raise her on the phone and not willing to holler for her over the mid-afternoon crowds. Finally, he rushed back to his office, flipped on the TV so he could catch Carpathia's final remarks, and got on his computer to be sure the new safe house was accessible. He called Rayford, who filled him in on everything since they had last spoken.
"I can trust Albie, can't I, David?"
"Albie?
He was your find, wasn't he? We've been working fairly closely lately. I think he's the best, and you and Mac always said he was. Anyway, he's one of us now, right?"
"Right. If you doubt him, check his mark. Apparently you don't insult Middle Eastern men that way.
Hey, Captain, you're talking to one.
Would someone checking your mark insult you?"
"Well, I suppose if you did after knowing me so long. I mean, I don't think you ever have."
"If I can't trust you, David, who can I trust?"
"I'd say the same about Albie, but you're the one who needs to feel right about it. We're getting in pretty deep with him, looks like."
"I've decided to take the risk."
"That's good enough for me. Let me know when you get to the Strong Building. You're going to try to put down inside the tower?"
"Not with this load. I'll keep the chopper as inconspicuous as I can so it won't be seen from the air. The most you'd have to worry about would be satellite shots, because no planes are flying low enough to shoot anything meaningful. But if you get unloaded and can determine before daybreak that the chopper can be housed way up inside there, you'd better do it."
"Roger. I'm unlocking everything in the place for you. I'd get in, get settled, and stay quiet and out of sight."
"We need some black spray paint."
"Can do. Where should I ship it?"
"Kankakee, I guess."
"You got it, Rayford. How is Zion?"
"Chaim and Buck are the banged up ones.
But they're going to be all right, right?"
"Looks like it."
"Zion is the one I worry about. We need him online and doing what he does best."
Rayford guessed he was halfway to the safe house.
"I hear that, David. I just hope we can transmit out of the new place like we could out of the old."
"Should be able to. When the day comes for Mac and Smitty and Annie and me to get out of here, we'll come and set up the greatest communication center you can imagine. Hey, you've got your laptop, right?"
"I had left it in Mount Prospect. I'll get back online in Chicago."
"Good, because I sent you a list I found made by a woman named Viv Ivins, Carpathia's oldest confidant. It shows the 10 kingdoms with their new names, but it also has a number assigned to each one. There has to be some significance, but I can't decipher it, at least not yet."
"You haven't put one of your fancy computer programs on it by now?"
"Soon, but I don't care what it takes or who figures it out. I just want to know what it means and whether there's any advantage to our knowing it."
"We'll take a shot at it. For now, it's going to be great to be back together, all in one place, getting caught up with each other, getting acquainted better with the newcomers and reestablishing some order. I'll know when you get in. I've got my cameras on."
With his computer set, David wanted to return his attention to finding Annie. There were 1,000 reasons she might be hard to locate, but he'd rather not consider any of them. He stood and stretched, noticing that the TV picture had changed. The network had switched from a wide shot of the receiving trilogy of Leon, Viv, and Nick, and now moved in on Nikolai. He had stepped down a few rows and looked directly into the camera. In spite of himself, David could see why the man was so riveting. Besides the rugged European handsomeness, he really sold the care and compassion. David knew he was insidious, but his smarminess didn't show. The announcer said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the global community, your supreme potentate, His Excellency Nikolai Carpathia." Nikolai took one step closer to the camera, forcing it to refocus. He looked directly into the lens. "My dear subjects," he began, "we have together endured quite a week, have we not? I was deeply touched by the millions who made the effort to come to New Babylon for what turned out to be, gratefully, not my funeral. The outpouring of emotion was no less encouraging to me.
As you know, and as I have said, there remain small pockets of resistance to our cause of peace and harmony. There are even those who have made a career of saying the most hurtful, blasphemous, and false statements about me, using terms from me that no person would ever want to be called. I believe you will agree that I prove today who I am and who I am not. You will do well to follow your heads and your hearts and continue to follow me. You know what you saw, and your eyes do not lie. I am also eager to welcome into the One World fold any former devotees of the radical fringe who have become convinced that I am not the enemy. On the contrary, I may be the very object of the devotion of their own religion, and I pray they will not close their minds to that possibility. In closing, let me speak directly to the opposition. I have always, without rancor or acrimony, allowed divergent views. There are those among you, however, who have referred overtly to me personally as the Antichrist, and this period of history as the tribulation. You may take the following as my personal pledge. If you insist on continuing with your subversive attacks on my character and on the world harmony I have worked so hard to engender, the word tribulation will not begin to describe what is in store for you. If the last 3.5 years are your idea of tribulation, wait until you endure the Great Tribulation. Epilogue. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. Revelation chapter 12, verse 12.
The End. You've been listening to The Indwelling by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, narrated by Richard Ferrone. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.